Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber, your host. Joining me for today's show is Dominique Lisansky, Public Policy Director at GSMA, an international trade association representing mobile operators and dedicated to supporting the mobile industry in its work, including standards, infrastructure deployment, and other related activities. She is based in London, but joining us in DC today. So Dominique, thank you for coming by the office.
Thank you very much.
So I wanted to start with kind of just a general discussion of where tech policy in Europe is today. Most of these shows, we talk about tech policy in the United States, but of course, the internet is naturally a global entity, and it's important to see what our friends across the pond are up to. So what's the state of play?
So we have a variety of issues going on within Europe, and Europe being the 28 member states that belong to the European Union at the moment. And those issues are related to digital policy in general, digital commerce, internet issues, infrastructure issues, things along those lines. In particular, there's quite a number of specific things that are going on. We've recently seen the European Union investigating Google for antitrust issues, especially around the Android operating system. We're also seeing the greater implementation of the digital single market, where roaming rates across member states for mobile users, which tend to be most people in Europe at the moment, are going to be terminated completely by the end of next year.
And let's just, we'll start with that one. So we had Massimiliano Trovato, who you know from an Italian think tank, on the show to talk a little bit about the DSM. But for listeners who didn't hear that one, the digital single market is basically designed to harmonize regulations throughout the member states. And while in theory that can be good, there's also some concerns about competition. And it might be counterintuitive to think that there's anything wrong with eliminating roaming. Listeners in the United States who they might remember a time when they would leave their East Coast house and get on a plane and arrive in another city and realize they couldn't use their phone without incurring horrendous charges. I'm pretty sure the four major wireless carriers in the United States now offer unlimited nationwide plans. But in Europe, the idea that you would remove roaming sounds great, right? You don't have to pay any fees. You can hop around the EU all you want and talk unlimited. So what's the problem there?
Well, what it is doing is it's mandating effectively price controls across the 28 member states in Europe. And while roaming itself is a contentious and very emotional issue, and I definitely remember when I lived in California, you know, coming to visit my family in New Jersey about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and having issues with, you know, expensive roaming. Roaming costs in general have gone down, especially in Europe. There's a lot more competition. 4G LTE is pretty significantly rolled out. There are MVNOs, which are virtual operators, you know, so it's quite a good mix of choice that consumers have. And so roaming prices continue to drop. But mandating this means that there's no competition across in this particular area. And I think that that's a bit of a quick fix for the European Union to do, basically, so that they're perceived as being doing good across Europe.
And what ends up happening is that people like you, who actually travel a lot and might benefit from not having a roaming plan, you will be treated the same as a customer that stays in the same country his whole life. He might never leave Italy or wherever he happens to live. He might never leave, never has a reason to use his cell phone in a country where his account wasn't opened. Mm-hmm. And yet his prices are going to be higher because now that the carriers have to offer a one-size-fits-all plan, unlimited, no roaming charges, those heavy users who travel all over the place, you know, people who work for the EU, bureaucrats, Brusselcrats, as we sometimes call them, they're hopping all over the place, getting on and off trains and planes, they benefit. But then the people who would have wanted maybe a cheaper plan that included roaming fees because they knew they never were going to roam anyway, that's not an option anymore.
Yeah, and it'll be more expensive. There's no stopping the fact that, like, we all know that investment needs to increase in the mobile industry. But unfortunately, the problem is, where do you get the money for investment? And capital investment is very expensive, especially with next generation networks. And so there needs to be some way to charge users for what they're using. So data heavy users obviously should be charged more. So people like me, who spend a significant time traveling across Europe, have has a have a higher roaming rate, right, at the moment. But that roaming rate is still £3 a day, which isn't that expensive if you think about it in the long term.
Yeah, and it seems like there's this push to define the internet as somehow different than almost any other industry. Mm-hmm. And of course, the internet's important. No one's disputing that. But paying for what you use, I mean, that's pretty standard. You go to a restaurant, you order more food, you pay more. I mean, like,
order drinks.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there are people, activists, who think the internet is somehow special, and that no matter if you're a 5 terabyte a month power user downloading every single video and music album you can find, or your grandma who checks her email like once a day and barely uses any email, that those two people should both only have unlimited plans that might cost more as a result.
Right. And I'm not a data heavy user when I travel for obvious reasons. I get on wireless, you know, Wi-Fi and wireless networks for work and things. So I don't want to pay for my 2 gigabit a month usage versus somebody else, you know, paying the same for 20 gigabits a month. But, you know, this is the way it's going in Europe. And this also speaks to another issue in Europe, which is the continued debate on net neutrality and in particular on zero rating, which you have here in the US, but it's certainly a hot debate across Europe as well.
And in Europe, they've taken a more permissive approach with regards to net neutrality. I know that zero rating has been explicitly authorized. Those regulations are on the books, whereas in the United States, we have a case-by-case approach right now where the FCC is being really mealy-mouthed about zero rating. And listeners, when we say zero rating, we mean certain services being exempt from data use rules. So if you get 4 gigabytes a month from T-Mobile and you watch video under the Binge On program, it doesn't count towards the 4 gigs. So you got 4 gigs to use everything else. It sounds great for consumers, but there are activists who say it's a net neutrality violation because everything on the internet should be treated the same and all bits are equal. But it's pretty interesting that Europe has taken a less heavy-handed approach to the issue of net neutrality than the United States, when generally the perception is that the US is better in terms of allowing for experimentation of business models and it's a much more friendly environment to tech. But in this case, Europe's kind of eating our lunch money.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, industry or country to country specific. So in the Netherlands, for example, there is a net neutrality law. Netherlands also has a couple fewer mobile operators than the UK, where the UK currently has 4, and there's, you know, a lot of transition and consolidation going on at the moment. But the UK government has taken the approach on net neutrality in particular, in that what they're doing is a code of conduct that involves all stakeholders in a multi-stakeholder model, including the mobile operators, fixed line, civil society, different government offices. And what they do is they created initially a couple years ago a code of conduct on net neutrality, but effectively it was transparency in pricing and traffic management, which seems like a best viable way basically for consumers, right? It's a win-win for consumers. Consumers basically can see what the regulations are, what different operators, how they operate differently, and, you know, provide more information for choice. And that code of conduct, just to let you know, in the UK constantly gets reviewed and updated by those stakeholders every 6 to 12 months. So it's a perfect approach, I think, in that way, and very much industry led.
And when we talk about the EU right now, there's a big debate in Britain going on about the Brexit, the referendum where the UK voters will be voting on whether to leave the European Union. And I want to talk about that in the vein of tech policy. The EU has its, you know, crusade against Google and Facebook and their approach to roaming and net neutrality and all these things. And the UK has kind of always been one of the more independent member states of the EU. They have their own currency. They maintained the pound. They have often been skeptical of the much more socialist approach that the EU takes as opposed to their more free market approach. So, general question, is there a gulf between the UK's approach to technology policy versus the rest of the member states in the EU?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, it's my opinion that the UK tends to be less prescriptive in enacting European directives, which are effectively guidance for regulation that need to come into force in a certain amount of time. But what you're seeing in London in particular, but actually across the whole UK and in other cities like Manchester and is a great example, and other places in northern England, is there's this huge growth in tech startups. And in particular in London, the biggest tech tech startup group of people and companies is fintech. And so
that's financial technology, including Bitcoin.
Yeah, lots of Bitcoin, lots of sort of just innovative sort of new approaches to transferring money. And TransferWise, for example, which maybe a company people have heard of, is based in London and was founded in London. And the point of it was to be able to transfer money easily internationally and reduce the rates of doing that. So what you're seeing is in the UK, you have probably the largest tech startup sort of group of people than anywhere else, Berlin probably being second. And then, of course, you have a lot of coders and people like that in Eastern Europe. But because the economy and some of the small to medium sized enterprise tax laws and regulations and stuff actually favor and foster tech startups in the UK, you see it actually happening, right? And in different countries, you know, France is a great example. Unfortunately, they're much more prescriptive in terms of how they regulate technology companies. They need to have culturally acceptable as well as French-based culture content and things like that. And you don't see the same burgeoning of startups. So to your question and to your end, that's exactly right, right? So because they're sort of not as hands-on, because the UK government has taken that decision and the regulator has taken that decision, you're seeing a flourishing of startups.
And you've talked about EU directives, and you characterize that as a guideline for regulation. And if the UK decides to interpret a directive and just say, you know, we're not going to take this as strong, or we're going to dilute this a little bit or water it down, or other countries decide that they want to take the directive further and be more regulatory, how many teeth do these directives have? I mean, is there a penalty for not complying? I mean, it's kind of confusing, I guess, to the United States, where we don't really have these types of, I mean, we incorporate UN treaties into our law. We're one of the few countries that does that. But we don't really have these kind of vague guidelines about how to regulate coming from Brussels. So how does that work?
I guess I should say they're more mandated guidelines. They have to be installed within each country by a certain amount of time. And if not, there are penalties and particular issues that result, including, you know, for example, antitrust investigations and things like that. What I've seen in the UK is that though a directive may come out and they may say, so a directive that that I like to talk about a lot, it happened about 5 years ago, I guess, it was called the cookie directive. It was effectively saying that you had to ask permission on a website for any users who come onto that website before they can continue using the website. You know, do you accept our terms of agreement on cookies, right? And those were pop-up boxes, dialogue boxes, things like that. And that reason that exists across Europe is because of an EU directive. Now, the UK took the decision, as far as I can remember, not to basically press it too hard. So what they did is they said, okay, if you want to comply with this, fine. And complying means you can then trade and be interoperable with the rest of Europe, thus facilitating a single market, digital single market, which is how the EU kind of frames it. But basically, you know, if you want to do business across Europe, you have to have these directives. So effectively, you have to put them into practice when it impacts industry. So effectively, the information commissioner in the UK said, look, we're not going to fine anybody. We're not going to do anything really difficult. Just, you know, get on with what you're doing and do it eventually, right? So whereas other countries, and I would say probably France, but I can't really remember off the top of my head, would actually say, if you don't put this dialogue box or pop-up box on your website by a certain date, we will fine you a certain amount of money. And the UK just chose not to do that.
Yeah. And if listeners have been to Europe, you might've noticed that it's a very different experience. And I guess in the United States, there's less anxiety about commercial privacy and consumer privacy. I mean, people know that companies like Facebook and Google collect their data, but I think there's an understanding here among most Americans that that's necessary for the business model. It's important, and it's different than what the NSA does, which could be a constitutional violation. Whereas in Europe, I don't think they see the two issues as separate. And we've talked a little bit about how internet governance works in Europe, because the EU plays a role and then individual member states have an obligation to implement those rules. But let's talk about internet governance more generally. What the hell, first of all, is the term internet governance? What does it mean? Because it's kind of a murky issue, and it's tough to even conceptualize someone being in charge of the internet. It's such a decentralized entity in many ways. So give us a short primer on internet governance.
So I think if you ask any individual person what internet governance is, everyone will have a different answer, right? So for me, internet governance is the governance of the internet in terms of policy making. And most people here in the US actually associate it primarily with ICANN and what ICANN does in terms of domain name systems and managing critical resources for internet and specifically for websites. But more generally, it has to do with issues that include cybersecurity policy, capacity building, rollout of the mobile internet, just about everything, content. And it's the idea that you bring stakeholders together who wish to participate in different areas related to internet policy to come up with plans or ways forward or how this is going to work in the future. And so there's something called the Internet Governance Forum, which is going to be in its 11th year this year, actually, that where people come from all over the world and it's in a different place every year and they meet to talk about specific issues. And those issues are usually hot topics for that year. Again, zero rating and net neutrality has always been a pretty hot topic, but also access, how to roll out infrastructure, how to get access to people in developing and underdeveloped countries is another big internet governance issue. And also the other thing is cybersecurity, the tension between national sovereignty and national security versus what you were just saying, security, consumer security, surveillance, all those issues are huge topics in this particular arena, which involves people, governments as well as civil society, think tanks, academia, private sector. So internet governance is a very messy sort of thing, a process, I guess I should say, that's ongoing. And within Europe in particular, there's an internet governance forum that's specific to Europe. So every June, Europeans, countries, governments, nation states, civil society across different countries within Europe, private sector, come together to talk about Europe-specific internet issues. So this year, there will be a continued focus on zero rating. That's something that's really quite fascinating. But also, again, another issue with privacy. The issue in Europe with privacy, especially in internet governance fora, is the idea that U.S. companies are hosting the data in the U.S. And that continues to be a theme we see because it's something that I'm sure you've talked about for many, many years, but it's still a big issue.
We've talked about digital protectionism, the danger of countries kind of getting nationalistic about the internet because it's a inherently global entity. And if countries start passing rules saying data on Europeans must be stored in Europe or data on British persons must be stored in the UK, that could throw up roadblocks. And one of the things that really made the internet so successful in particular between the EU and US was the Safe Harbor Agreement that since the year 2000 allowed for cross-border data flows with the assumption that everything's, as long as there's no egregious violations, everything's fine. And because of our failure to get our shit together on surveillance in many ways and our failure to address the Snowden leaks, we haven't really done much to reform our practices from a foreign standpoint. We've done more to protect Americans in the aftermath, but not Europeans. That's been a problem. And we don't want to see a situation where American tech companies, which are arguably even more popular in Europe than they are here sometimes. I mean, Google has a bigger market share on search in Europe than it does in the United States. And Facebook's obviously very popular, WhatsApp. We don't want to see these companies losing customers because of the things we do. We don't want to see bad policy. And we don't want to see this data localization necessarily, because it can be dangerous for every country to start mandating the data be stored there, because not every country is respected of people's privacy. And you could see China having data storage laws that are much worse than the United States, for example.
Absolutely. And I think the data flow issue is really interesting because it not just speaks to privacy, but it also speaks to sort of how the internet works, so how data flows, literally how it works in terms of a technical aspect of things. Your traffic, right, might go out from outside the country somewhere else and then back into the country based on how IXPs and exchanges work and things like that. And limiting that would actually impact the infrastructure of the internet as well and be challenging, quite frankly.
Yeah, and you don't want to see people having intranets, right? Where it's like, I mean, Cuba has one of those because of the regime and being under communist rule for, 7 decades, the people kind of put together a local internet where they literally smuggle content from the United States to Cuba and then disseminate it on a local area network. And that's out of necessity. That's a response to bad policy and a being closed off to the rest of the world. But we could see that happening through policy in democratic regimes. If you require everything to be stored in your own country, you might only have local companies that can serve your consumers instead of global companies. And that's not something we want. And it's a lot of it's driven by surveillance, but a lot of it's also driven by just opportunistic dictators who just want to take advantage of the chaos and say, you know, because of the US, we're going to now mandate everything be stored here. So that brings me to the UN, because recently in the United States, the FCC declared that the internet is basically telecom. It's no longer an information service. It's a telecommunication service. It's to be treated as a public utility. The UN has a group, the International Telecommunications Union, which has a role in regulating telecom. So now that the United States has declared the internet to be telecom, is the ITU going to be getting involved? And just kind of give us an idea of what their role in internet governance is.
Absolutely. And don't tell them too loudly about that. The ITU is probably best known as a UN organization because of the WICCAT, the World Conference. On information or international telecommunications. Sorry, so many acronyms that took place at the end of 2012, which was quite a big deal. And we, as we know, the U.S. walked away from signing that treaty. However, a number of nation states said they would sign the treaty probably about 80 or 90, I think, if I remember correctly. But I only found out recently, only five have actually enshrined that treaty into law worldwide. So still to this day, people are very nervous about that conference that took place 4 years ago where the UN was going to take over the internet.
And part of that is because there are countries that have influence in the UN that are just not respective or don't respect civil liberties.
Absolutely.
I mean, China and Russia both have vetoes in the Security Council, and they would love nothing more than the UN to be getting more involved in the internet, because that's a vehicle that they would arguably have a better chance of getting what they want than a multi-stakeholder process that would naturally include organizations like Human Rights Watch at the table, which would not be very, which would be very skeptical of Russia and China and what they want for the internet. So
absolutely. I think that the biggest issue is that as telecoms infrastructure becomes the delivery of the internet, it is the delivery of the internet. You know, you see that the ITU feels that its remit is into the internet because of that. There's quite a lot of proposals and discussions at annual meetings that discuss things like, you know, IPv6, for example, and how to roll that out, things that are best left to regional internet registries and you know, different sort of NGOs, including like the information or the Internet Society, ISOC, and things like, you know, things like those, companies like those, groups like those that we've seen. And of course, private sector plays probably the biggest role in rolling out internet infrastructure, especially the mobile industry.
Right.
So the ITU gets its sort of remit, you know, expanded quite a lot by certain countries that you just mentioned, because they're basically effectively see the ITU as a legitimate organization. And one way to legitimize that organization in an ongoing way is to make sure that their remit becomes broader, right? And this is a huge issue, obviously. And, you know, unfortunately, since the WICCAT, this hasn't changed. This continues to be a problem. And the ITU plays important roles, for example, in spectrum harmonization in its radio sector. Huge, it's hugely important for all of us worldwide when we travel in Rome at the moment, you know, to coordinate that. And that's something they do and do really well. But then when they get into other areas, it's a little bit difficult. They host a forum every year called the WISIS Forum, which brings together a number of stakeholders to talk about internet policy making as well. And that's something they do on an annual basis that continues probably their visibility within the internet, internet governance as well. And they participate in the Internet Governance Forum, obviously, for a variety of reasons, they're speakers on other things as well. But it's just making sure that in this whole sort of arena of internet policymaking, there are different organizations, different companies that have roles and responsibilities, and making sure that all those are kept within their remit actually helps facilitate the rollout of the internet and internet infrastructure. So
there's no shortage of fascinating issues regarding internet governance, and it'll be striking to see how the different nations of the world and different regions of the world have different approaches. And we mentioned some of the differences between the EU and the US, and we'll certainly be discussing these issues more and more on the show. But that's it for today. My guest has been Dominique Lozanski, Public Policy Director at GSMA, an international trade association representing mobile operators. Dominique, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Let us know what you think of the show on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on our Facebook page. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org if you have ideas, comments, anything you question you'd like answered on the show. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. And thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.